I have a handout that I'm going to hand out when it's time to look at, not yet. So today, it's a very short fast. You know, the sun rises late in the day. It sets early in the day. It's not so hot outside like the other fasts. We're not so thirsty. It's very easy to walk through an Asar B'Teves and to feel that, okay, it's done. Dinner's going to be in a little bit. And the fast is over. And to not, feel dramatic or to feel that something significant happened today. So what I want to do is I want to combine two different machshavas from two different Gedol Yisrael and perhaps suggest that they might be saying the same idea, speaking to the same point, and perhaps walk away with a message related to the fast. The Beis Yosef asks and raises perhaps the most famous halakhic points about Asar B'Teves, that theoretically, according to the Vudraham and other Rishonim, that if the 10th of Teves were to fall on Shabbos, we would observe the fast on Shabbos. In fact, it is the only fast that we could potentially observe on Friday according to the calendar. And technically, we actually do go into Shabbos in those circumstances fasting. So we actually do fast a little bit of Asar B'Teves on Shabbos. And although it can't mathematically fall on Shabbos, the stringent nature of Asar B'Teves seems to be in total contradistinction to everything I said at the beginning. It's a very short day. It's not so hot outside. We can go through most of the events of the day and not think about the fast and not even be so hungry and not even contemplate what we're doing and think about the siege. But nevertheless, what seems to be the lightest and the easiest of the fast carries the most stringent and the most difficult aspects of it. So a lot of the Acharim discuss the Beis Yosef. The Chassam Sofer writes in the Torah's motion, Dvarim, why is it that we, in general, don't fast on Shabbos? How come when a fast day comes, why don't we fast on Shabbos? Because it's a lack of Oneg Shabbos. It's not in the spirit of Shabbos. It's not enjoyment of Shabbos to be hungry, to be thinking about your growling stomach, and that does not fit within the spirit of the day. However, we do know that if a person does get Oneg, if a person does get a pleasure from fasting, so they are allowed to fast on Shabbos. The halacha is that if a person has a bad dream on Friday night and they want to have a tainus chalom, whatever the reasons are, a tainus chalom, fasting over a bad dream, or as Arshko would call it, the amelioration of a dream, only applies to the next day. If you don't do it right away, so all of the good stuff that comes with it doesn't work to that bad dream. So if a person has a bad dream Friday night, the halacha is they can fast the next day. Now, happens to be if they fast, they have to fast another time because they fasted on Shabbos, so it's almost a cycle of fasting. But technically, a person can fast on Shabbos because of the Oneg Shabbos. Because why? Because the person believes that the fasting is going to be good in the future for my situation. All other fasts, says the Chassam Sofer, because of what happened in the past. We fast on Tisha B'Av because of what was. We fast the Shiva Asar B'Tammuz of what was, and so I'm going to die. All that is about what was in the past. But a tainus chalom, says the Chassam Sofer, is a fast about the future. I had a bad dream. What's going to be with this dream in the future? That's the difference. And therefore, says the Chassam Sofer, Asar B'Teves is a fast about what is to happen, but not what happened, but rather about what's going to happen. What's going to happen? So the Chassam Sofer says that an Asar B'Teves, every Asar B'Teves, today in Shemayim, passes the Chassam Sofer, there was a B'din Torah. The Beis Din Shemala sat, the Malachim, whoever is there, sitting together with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and they sat and discussed whether the Beis HaMikdash should be destroyed. Because on the first Asar B'Teves, they sat and had such a Din Torah. What will be? And whether arguments amongst Chazal and the Mefarshim, a year and a half siege, 3.5 year siege, whatever it was, whoever the length of the siege was, they decided on Asar B'Teves what the outcome would be already, that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed. Every single year, when the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt, says the Chassam Sofer, it is because that Beis Din sat again today on the 10th of Teves and decided, will it be rebuilt in this coming year or not? And if the generation is not worthy, as we know, of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, it says it's as if it was destroyed in that generation. And therefore, every generation, the psak comes from Shemayim, what will be for the coming year? Will the Beis HaMikdash be rebuilt? Yes, I know you're thinking that gets into a lot of theological issues. Can we still daven going forward to the Beis HaMikdash this year? Does that mean Mashiach's not going to come? Whatever within the Torah of the Chassam Sofer, this is how he approaches the issue. that today, on this, the last 24 hours, there was a discussion, would the Beis HaMikdash be rebuilt or not? And therefore, he says, because this fast is about the judgment of what will be in the future, just like the fast of a Tanis Chalom, a fast of a bad dream is about what will be in the future, therefore it can take place on Shabbos. That is the Chiddush of the Chassam Sofer as it relates to Asar B'Tevis. Now, let's put that to the side. Based on this, I want to discuss a different idea. There is a letter of the Chazon Ish. The letter of the Chazon Ish in the Igros in Chelek Aleph and Igeres Sadi Zayin. The Chazon Ish is asked about, soon after the Holocaust, establishing days of fasting in order to commemorate the events of what Chorban Europa, the events of what happened in Europe. And the Chazon Ish essentially says no. He says, we can't be mechadish new things. We can't come up with new dinim derabbanan, certainly not new dinim deoraisa. And he says, we're dalim v'reikim in ha-torah v'arumim mitzvos. We're on such a low level, we can't come up with new things. Now, the rest of the letter that's not printed in the Igros Chazon Ish, essentially the Chazon Ish was asked about, can we make a new fast day for our families that were lost, that we don't know their yurt sites, we don't know how to establish who was lost and who was killed in the Holocaust, what can we do? What was the Chazon Ish's answer? His answer was, make Asar B'Tevis. Since Asar B'Tevis is the yesod and the foundation of all future tragic events, the Chazon Ish felt that the 10th of Tevis should be the event that families who do not know what happened to their loved ones in the Holocaust should fast and commemorate what happened during Chorban Europa. And that was his response to them. That response was adopted by the Chief Rabbi of Israel. In 1949, I pulled this from the website of the Rav HaRashi. It says, Bishnas 1949, Kavu Moetzes HaRabbanus HaReishis U'Misrad Hadassus. The religious offices and the chief rabbi established, Sheyom Zeh should be Yom HaKadosh HaKlali B'Zecher Niftarim V'Nirtzachim. That the 10th of Tevis should be a day established to commemorate everyone who was lost in the Holocaust. Yom Zeh Yom HaKadosh HaKlali B'Zecher Korbanos HaShoah. To commemorate those who were lost in the Holocaust. Ba'achlata zuba liyadei bitu yashkafa, ki chorban yahadus Europa, hu chelek bilti nefrad me'ahereg v'achorban, shepakdu es am Yisrael mishchar historia. And the point was that the Jewish people should know that the Holocaust is not something separate from all of the tragedies of Jewish history. That it all stems from the original psak din in Shemayim, of Asar B'Tevis, that all the Beis HaMikdash should be destroyed, and everything terrible would come from that point. And therefore, this is what's established. What is practiced in Israel today? I don't know. I don't know what people do on Asar B'Tevis in Eretz Yisrael, but this is what is established and on the books of what should be done regarding that. This touches upon a very controversial and famous essay from Rav Huttner. This is the piece that I pulled from over here. We could pass it around. Just some of the... This is from an essay from Rav Huttner. The background to the essay, the bark of the essay is more scary than the bite itself. In the 1960s, 1970s, Rav Huttner spoke somewhere in regards to how to approach the Holocaust and try to give some sort of understanding, which is obviously on its own a controversial topic, and there's a lot of obviously a lot of pain and nerves and feelings wrapped up in that. It was printed in the Jewish Observer in 1970-something. It was the speech was transcribed and edited and put together by two of Rabbi Huttner's Talmidim. One is Rabbi Feitman from the Red Shul, and the other is Rabbi Chaim Foreman, who was my principal in elementary school. And they worked together to put this essay out, and it was published in Jewish Observer. There was a tremendous response to the essay, some positive, some not as positive, regarding Rav Huttner's stance. He took a very strong position. I'm not interested right now in his strong position vis-a-vis the Holocaust and why and what happened. I'm just interested in an opening piece that Rav Huttner discusses, and then we'll try to tie it back in. And we'll just read from some of the selected pieces here. As in all quests for the truth, we must return to the origins. The term Shoah was coined by the founders of Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, since they were convinced that the tragedy of European Jewry was so unique in its proportions and dimensions that no previous phrase could encompass its meaning. Undoubtedly, to a certain degree, they were correct. For indeed, the destruction of hundreds of thousands of Jewish communities was unique in its proportions and dimensions. Yet, By singling out the quantitative differences of the particular Chorban, those who sought a new terminology for these events missed the essence of their uniqueness. It is not just the proportions and dimensions of the Holocaust which define its quintessence, but its establishment of the new and significant pattern of Jewish history. Yet at the same time, it must be stressed that this pattern, far from coincidental, is intricately related to the basic pattern of Jewish history itself, and profoundly affects our entire vision of recent history and indeed current events. By placing the Holocaust in its historical perspective, we shall uncover two new directions in recent Jewish history with reference to the Gentile persecution of the Jews. Whereas our entire history has been replete with various instances of persecution by different civilizations, empires, and nations, varying only in intensity, means, and ferocity, recent history has shifted dramatically in two new areas. So Rav Huttner says a mistake that one could walk away from the events of the Holocaust is that it's isolated and not connected to the context of what it means to be a Jew. However, he says, there is something different in what happened that also needs to be noted. And he goes through a little bit of Jewish history. The first of these epochal changes involves the shift from generations of Gentile mistreatments of Jews, which if unwelcome is nevertheless expected and indeed announced by our oppressors, to an era where promises of equality were made and then broken, rights were granted and then revoked, benevolence was anticipated only to be crushed by cruel malevolence. Meaning, in the olden days, we knew what the guy felt about us. But only in more recent times was it couched in a different approach. This change to our historical pattern, though, although it has hitherto gone largely unnoticed, is nevertheless a seminal movement in our progress towards Acharis Hayamim, the inevitable culmination of history in absolute redemption. The recent examples of these disappointments may be readily brought to mind, and indeed some are yet fresh with the pain of unfulfilled anticipation. The French Revolution, in that first 18th century burst of dedication to equality and freedom, had granted equal rights to Jews as citizens, although nothing to Jews as Jews. The Treaty of Versailles had gone even further and granted rights of minorities as minorities, including Jews as Jews. Of course, these promises were later nullified or retracted and heard from no more. In Russia, too, Lenin had signed in 1917 the Soviet Minority Rights Law, granting a kind of Jewish self-government in the form of the Jewish Soviet. This, too, was soon abolished by 1920s by Stalin, dashing those bright hopes that had been kindled. England, too, entered the 20th century by revoking a promise made to Jews in the form of the Balfour Declaration. November 1917, Jews danced in the streets because Britain had declared that His Majesty's government viewed with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The declaration was accepted at the Conference of San Remo 1920. Yet by June 1922, Winston Churchill, then British Colonel Secretary, was qualifying that the declaration does not mean the imposition of a Jewish nationality upon the inhabitants of Palestine as a whole, but the further development of the existing Jewish community. Of course, a long and bitter period followed where a British hand held the gun of the age-old oppressor of Israel. Thus, it becomes clear that the trend of anti-Jewish phenomena of the first half of the 20th century was characterized not so much by persecutions and pogroms as the past, but by legalized retraction of existing existing laws granting sundry privileges. Although these reversals are dramatic and telling enough of themselves, they pale in the face of the retractions and total turnabouts made by the Germans in the 1920s and the 1930s. In March 11, 1812, Prince Karl August von Hardenberg had issued the famous edict emancipating Prussian Jews, but by 1919, as a supplement to the German translation of the so-called Protocols of the Elders of Zion, Gottfried Zurbich, Ludwig Miller, used Hardenberg's definition of a Jew in drafting proposals for anti-religious legislation. These proposals culminated in 1935 in the so-called Nuremberg Laws, which legitimized anti-Semitism and legalized anti-Jewish bigotry. These Rassengesetz, which forbade marriage between Germans and Jews and disenfranchised non-Aryans, exactly paralleled earlier rights and privileges legally granted to Jews. Thus the cycle was diabolically complete. What had been given legally was equally as legally taken away, leaving the Jewish people with a growing and ultimately exonerable disillusionment with the promises, even legal enactments of the Gentile world. Let us restate clearly the pattern we have discovered in recent Jewish history. Jews have always been beaten by Gentiles. Only the means and instruments of torment have varied. The innovation of recent times has been for long periods. Jews were deluded into trust in the Gentiles by a series of laws and regulations in their behalf, only to have the trust shattered by the rescission of those very laws. This historical period culminated in the Holocaust, the largest scale of annihilation of a people in history, yet resulting not from lawless hordes, but flowing directly from legalized and formal governmental edicts. The end result of the period for the Jewish psyche was significant, indeed, crucial one. From trust in the Gentile world, the Jewish nation was cruelly brought to a repudiation of the trust. In a relatively short historical period, disappointment in the non-Jewish world was deeply imprinted upon the Jewish soul. This point that Rav Huttner makes is seemingly very similar to the Chassam Sofer, and I'll try to explain. Is there any difference nowadays that Rav Huttner is saying? People are willing to give up so much so that Jews can travel more and have more freedom and go anywhere. We, Baruch Hashem, in certainly at this moment in time, something like the Abraham Accords and peace with Arab nations is a good thing. But that a person should be deluded into thinking that therefore that means that that will not be taken away, or they won't retract that at the drop of a hat and turn against us, says Rav Huttner, just means that a person doesn't understand Jewish history. This is the nature of the way of the world from the beginning of time. And we cannot rely or say that everything is going to be protected or everything is going to be handed to us just because something is on a piece of paper and something has been signed in a ceremony. To be a Jew means that there's a continuity of the self and to view oneself as part of the story of the Jewish people. A Jew understands that all of Jewish history and all of those who came before us are intrinsically linked to us. Avraham Avinu is not just our great-grandfather. He's a chelek, he's a part of who we are, and we are also a part of Avraham Avinu. It goes all the way back to the beginning. And there's no difference between what occurs to me 20 years ago than what occurs to me 2,000 years ago, because it's all happening to me. We're all part of the same bundle. A Jew understands that the Churban HaBayis happened to him. A Jew understands that the Inquisition happened to him, and a Jew understands that the Holocaust also happened to him as a member of the Jewish people. And that's what it means to be sensitive to Jewish history, as Rav Huttner is trying to paint. Now, the Meshech Chachma has a very similar idea to Rav Huttner. It's famous for one line. The Meshech Chachma writes by the Tochacha that the Jews of Berlin felt that they were living in Jerusalem. But he describes how Jews would move to a location, become familiar there, and then they would become successful, to the point they would say that Berlin is Jerusalem, and fall into that same trap again and think that this Gullus is where we're supposed to be, and these are the way things are supposed to be, and to be very comfortable in the Gullus that they've been handed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and by the nations around them. It's the same theme, by the way, in Megillas Esther. Right? Megillas Esther tells the exact same story. We felt emancipated, we felt entitled in the kingdom of Ahasuerus, we were feasting and rejoicing in the king's palace, like we were a member of society fully. We had a Jewish queen in the palace, and we felt that we were taken care of. And in a moment, all of that disappears and it's taken away, and we're in danger of being annihilated by Haman. This leads to fasting, tshuva, and then recognition, Ein lanu elo hisha'ein, ela avinu shemashamayim, that there's only a Kadosh Baruch Hu. The same message repeats itself again and again and again. So I want to tell a short version of a favorite story of mine that the Kloisenberg Rebbe would tell from time to time. When he was in Auschwitz, they were forced to sleep on the floor. He would say, 42 people to one barrack. The 42 people, he said, they started out with, he said, by the end of the week, 40 of them had died from disease. And it was only left in that barrack with the original person, one other man. And one evening, he turned to the man and he said, are you Jewish? And the man said, of course I'm Jewish. Why else would I be here? And he said, well, who are you? And he said, well, I used to be the president of the National Bank of Hungary. I was the most important financial position in all of Hungary. That meant, said the Kloisenberg Rebbe, this man's picture appeared on all of the money in Hungary. So he said to him, the next night, he said, are you Jewish? So the man said, no. So the Kloisenberg Rebbe said, but you told me the day before you were Jewish. So he said, I converted to Christianity. And he obviously abandoned his faith in order to become more respectable in society. So the Kloisenberg Rebbe said it was impossible to fall asleep. So we continued the conversation. And he's looking at this man, and he said to him, are you married? So he said, yes, but my wife's a Christian. So the Kloisenberg Rebbe asked the man, did she join you here in Auschwitz? So the man looked at him like he was out of his mind. Why would my wife come to me to this, you know, Gehenim on earth? Why would she come with me? So the Rebbe said to him, you know, I don't understand. Wouldn't a good wife go with her husband to the ends of the earth to do anything for him? Why wouldn't she come here? So he didn't pause. And then he said, did you live well with your wife? Did you treat her well? So he said, what kind of question is that? In the 30 years we lived together, I bought her the best of everything, jewelry, clothing, living space, all types of things. So the Rebbe said, I'm really shocked now. How is it possible you treated your wife so well for 30 years, and now she leaves you alone? So we stopped talking. The man had nothing else to say. And the next morning they went to work, and the next night he struck up the conversation again. The Rebbe wouldn't leave alone. He kept on shepherding this man. And he said, did you do a lot of important things for the Hungarian government? So he said, certainly. He says, when I was hired by the National Bank, the economy was depressed. The money we used, the currency, was worth nothing. You couldn't buy a thousand wouldn't buy you anything. But I worked very hard to make the economy prosperous, and we began to trade with the whole world, and I really pulled Hungary out of its financial situation and turned it into a great city of commerce. How is it you never heard of me? He said, the Rebbe said, I'm not involved with money and things like that. I'm not involved in business. And he said, you don't know who I am? My picture's on the money of all of Hungary. How do you not know who I am? So the Rebbe said, I'm not involved in these things. So then he said to him and said, how is it that you were sent here and the Hungarian people didn't come and pull you out? How come all these people that you saved and you helped their economy and you did everything for them, how come they didn't come and save you from this terrible camp that you're in? What happened to all the people you helped? And how come you were sent here? You did so much for them. So the man said, why are you pushing me? Why are you bothering me? You're provoking me. You're making me, it's already miserable here. Why are you making fun of me and pushing me down? So he said, maybe you can tell me why you're here. And he started to shout back at the Rebbe. So the Rebbe said, me, I'm a poor rabbi. I'm a Jew. But why would they care about me? I didn't do anything for a guy. I didn't give him a glass of water. So of course they're going to put me here. I had nothing special to do with them. They hate me, but you did so many good things for them. I would expect them to carry you on their shoulders out of this camp. I just don't understand. You converted to Catholicism. You became a pleat guy in order to be like them. You accepted them, and they ignored you. And what about your children? What do they do? So he said, my kids, one's a doctor, one's a lawyer. The third is a successful businessman. So the Rebbe asked the man, did you provide for them? You took care of them? Did I provide for them? I gave them the best education. I gave them whatever they needed, all the toys they could want. They had a lovely childhood. So did your children come and take you out of the camp here? So the man said, you know, no. But he said, even when a person dies, do the children at least come and escort the casket? Here, your children haven't done anything with you. They didn't follow you to the border, not a single one. So the man said, you're hurting me so much. You're bothering me. Leave me alone. So the Rebbe said, I don't want to annoy you. I just want to understand how you got to where you are right now. I don't understand. And they continued talking late into the night. On the third night of talking, the Rebbe didn't initiate with the man. The man initiated with the Kloisenberger Rebbe. And he said, you know, Rabbi, I've been thinking about what you said all day, and I came to the conclusion that you're right. And he expressed regret, charata, for having converted, for having married a non-Jewish woman, and spoiling his children so much. And he saw clearly that nothing from his life remained with him at all. And he began crying that I made a terrible mistake. And he began sobbing and sobbing over the mistake that he made with his life. On the fourth night, said the Kloisenberger Rebbe, the man was no longer alive. And the Rebbe told the Hasidim, he said, at least before the man died, he had Hihurei Tshuva, that he brought him to a place to recognize that he had made a mistake and that he needed to change the correction of his life. And this is the way he thought before he was led to his death. It's the same point that Rav Huttner is making. We are excited and happy about promises of all types of to go where we want, travel where we want, speak with who we want, eat what we want, and do whatever we want and be friends with whoever we want. And when it goes south, we're surprised and we're hurt. How could the guy say such things? The Gemara says in Bava Basra, v'chesed l'umim chatas, that the chesed done by the nations to the Jewish people, it's for themselves. It's not because there's an interest in the Jewish people only on our own. Asar b'teves is the beginning of the tsaros, as the Psalm Sofer said. It's the beginning of when everything went south. It's the seeds that began everything. It's the shoresh of where we stand right now. The reason we're standing here right now and not in a rebuilt Beis HaMikdash is because of the events of Asar b'teves. Someone with understanding will hopefully appreciate that the root contains everything that will come forth. A seed contains all of the DNA necessary to make every single apple that's going to come from that tree. It's all contained in the root of this very day. The lesson is trying to understand the first time and not having to suffer again. If we learn from the lessons of Asar B'Teves and learn to understand that Asar B'Teves is the beginning of everything and learn the lessons when they're easier and lighter and not have to suffer through them when they're more difficult and more challenging, because if we don't get the hint, it might have to be explained to us more clearly and in a more definitive way if we don't get that message at the Shoresh, at the beginning of Asar B'Teves, instead of having to wait till later on by a Chorban, by Tisha B'Av. Okay, we'll stop here. Sign for Marv.